Welcome to a special edition Diplomat Podcast on Turkmenistan Neutrality Day. Turkmenistan Neutrality Day is celebrated every year on December 12th. Turkmenistan is an outlier among post-Soviet countries. Its policy of positive neutrality has left it out of regional alliances like the CSO and NATO. Yet the policy is perhaps facing its most severe challenge yet, as the regime in Ashgabat is confronted with insurgents, border disputes, and economic challenges. Raising the question, why has Turkmenistan held on to its neutral foreign policy for so long, and can it continue this policy in the future? I'm your host, Ryan McCarroll. Joining me this hour will be Bradley Jardine, a postgraduate researcher at the University of Glasgow and regular contributor to the Diplomat's Crossroads Asia blog.
Turkmenistan'ın karşılığının çağını 23 yıllık bayramçılığına devletli geçirilen davaralı karı yürüyüşü nizamı kırıldı. Davaralı yürüyüşün serkerdesi Batpalkonik Yaşeliyev.
So it's a windy, stormy Friday night in Dublin, where we're recording this podcast from. And clearly, we have nothing better to do than discuss Turkmeni neutrality, because anyone who is interested in Turkmenistan foreign policy has nothing else to do on a Friday evening to begin with. So joining me is Bradley Jardine for a riveting discussion on the geopolitics of neutrality and also changing definitions or sort of understandings of what neutrality means in a post-Cold War era. So on December 12th, Turkmenistan will be celebrating Turkmenistan's Neutrality Day. So joining me now is Bradley Jardine, so we can have a little discussion about this. So Bradley, can you give us a little bit of information or background onto where Turkmenistan's neutrality or the policy of neutrality comes from?
Well, the policy of neutrality, what's important to understand is that it's very much attached to the regime or the leadership, particularly in the early years when the policy emerged. So, you know, in the early days of the collapse of the Soviet Union, Turkmenistan didn't have neutrality in its discourse at all. Actually, quite an open foreign policy. The concept of neutrality and the drive for pushing for this came when Niyazov's regime actually gained control over the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and it began to kind of attach itself to all of Turkmen society and political institutions. This is really when it began pushing for neutrality. So this is what's important to understand in Turkmenistan's case, is that the concept of neutrality is more of a domestically oriented regime preservation strategy. And this is particularly, so in 1995, they actually got the final recognition for it. It actually became a world UN recognized policy of neutrality. And it's since then, and even since 1992 onwards, it's really played a strong discourse in Turkmen propaganda.
Yeah, but I guess I'm a little bit confused. So neutrality is traditionally seen in the context of, you know, positioning yourself amongst international actors, right? Non-alignment, not taking sides, etc. Particularly in the context of the Cold War, it was pretty obvious, right? It was like,
yeah,
you're either allied with Washington or you're allied with Moscow, right? So I guess I'm a bit confused. What role does neutrality actually play? I mean, you mentioned that it somehow bolsters the regime, but how is it used as a propagandic sort of device? I mean, what is it that makes neutrality appealing to the regime in Turkmenistan now? Is there anything to be said about the role of Moscow or Washington, D.C. in this context, or is it purely a sort of rhetorical device designed to keep the elites in power locally?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, first of all, in terms of the rhetorical device, so the domestic orientation of it, neutrality, Turkmenistan's unusual because unlike the other states of Central Asia whose post-Soviet identity has been built on ancient or historical references to build their own nation-states or following historical events, Turkmenistan's post-Soviet identity is almost entirely constructed on the regime itself and the regime's achievements. So this is pretty much embodies the identity of Turkmenistan's political identity is pretty much embodied in the presidential figure of the regime itself, which is unusual because this means that neutrality is very much an extension of this ideational kind of quality that the leadership's built around itself. So this idea of Turkmenistan being a state of peace and security, stability, these are the things that the regime wants to be seen as embodying itself.
And yet the regime is obviously facing a great deal of sort of emergent threats, whether they are domestic insurgents in form of radical radical terrorists, or if it's the border disputes, not only along Afghanistan now, but also with Uzbekistan. So they're far from peaceful in some sense, right? So in this sense, what you're saying is that neutrality is much more just part of the sort of mantra of the regime, not necessarily an act of foreign policy.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, like I said, this was a domestic kind of core of neutrality, which actually, for the record, when we're talking about the border conflicts, it's highly clamped down on in the Turkmen media that this is not discussed at all. Because, of course, this defies the narrative that they've portrayed of this stability, which is important. The actual foreign policy orientation, however, during, again, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a lot of fears with Niyazov's regime that there would be a revanchist Russia's presence or re-establishment of the Soviet Union. So a lot of ways neutrality was a way of distancing itself from Russia, creating decoupling itself from the security frameworks and from a source of dependence. Since then, however, with particular the dependence on gas, Russia became more of a key partner in the later years. So the regime started to change its perceptions of Russia. So again, this neutrality ties in with threat perceptions of external actors as well as internal domestic ones. In 2003, with the assassination attempt on Niyazov's life, the regime had a huge crackdown on opposition. This was highly criticized by the international media. So of course, neutrality and a dependence on the Putin regime, Putin was seen as a main kind of benefactor or supporter of the regime, a patron who was useful to them. So in this sense, neutrality then became a way of insulating itself, isolating from the international community. And they were quite happy at this stage to actually have an active partnership with Russia.
So that's really interesting, because it seems to me like in the post-Soviet sort of, I don't really like calling it a collapse, because to me it was actually a very long sort of withdrawal of the Soviet state. And anyways, in this sort of post-Cold War, maybe is a better way of looking at it, in this post-Cold War order, I mean, different states are obviously choosing very different strategies in terms of how to confront what they view as a revanchist Russia, right? You've got the Baltic states, which have joined NATO, and they did so as quickly as they could. You have states like the Republic of Georgia, for example, which are trying to become members of NATO, but nonetheless have participated in missions in Afghanistan and elsewhere on behalf of NATO, right? So it seems to me like Turkmenistan, in some sense, is kind of in a league of its own, outside maybe the Scandinavian states, in choosing a strategy of neutrality rather than joining a sort of security bloc, be it the CSO or NATO. How do you think that Turkmenistan's neutrality then sort of compares to some of the neutrality paradigms or neutrality foreign policies that we see coming from the Scandinavian states?
Well, I mean, it's Turkmenistan's case, of course, very idiosyncratic. I mean, let's give some historical context. I mean, when we talk about Scandinavian neutrality, particularly, we can have a look at the distinctions between Finland and Sweden. So, of course, this ties in with different ideas of what neutrality is. In Finland's sense, it was a neutralized state, or what's referred to as Finlandization. This is whereby an external actor imposes neutrality in order to create a sort of buffer zone. Now, of course, there's obligations on the so-called buffer state towards its patron. So, for example, Finland needed to have a strong domestic military. It had a lot of conscription, this sort of thing, because this is to assure the patron that it will defend its territory if another external actor sought to invade through that territory. In the case of Sweden, it's different. It was a unilaterally declared neutrality. So it was always based on legitimacy through acting. So it became more of a normative actor and engaged in humanitarian projects and so forth to actually portray itself actively as a neutral state. It functioned kind of similarly. But in the post-Cold War setting, with this terms of buffering, competition between great powers kind of receded, and security became a more complex, interconnected understanding. Extraterritorial threats, terrorism, environmental politics, and so forth. So the concept of neutrality, particularly in realist scholarship, became quite redundant, actually. This state-to-state conflict was, you know, no longer relevant in the literature. So they developed this concept now in the reframing as post-neutrality. So this understanding that it's a small state normative actor, this idea of promoting norms and values, peace-building values, and non-militarism. So this sort of normative, goal-oriented strategy of the small states in Scandinavia is very different to Turkmenistan, which is more traditional, kind of isolated actor. It's not seeking to extend itself, even though the propaganda does say it's seeking to promote norms of peace in the region. It's not really done much of that. I mean, during the civil war in Tajikistan, Turkmenistan did act as a peace actor and for negotiations between the parties. For the Taliban as well, it has had a lot of peace building operations inside the country, but other than that, it's not really a normative actor. Again, this is about regime preservation and kind of pragmatic values of and perceptions of threat.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting to me as well, because it seems to me that sometimes, you know, in an effort to be a part of the international system and to be a part of the, you know, so-called liberal world order, we get into this kind of muddled understanding of what neutrality really is, right? So we have states like Sweden and Finland who are participating overtly with you know, NATO, with their Partnership for Peace programs, with their joint trainings, even though they're not member states, right? And we get all sorts of interesting arrangements whereby you have different neutral states either tacitly working with different alliances or different sort of military powers, or are doing it overtly. And I think that's true with Turkmenistan as well. One of the things that I'm interested in is how neutrality is understood even in the context of, you know, something like the Northern Distribution Network, for example, whereby U.S. soldiers or NATO soldiers are transported through Russia and then through Turkmenistan into Afghanistan. So, is it really a neutral state if you allow, for example, this sort of troop transport?
I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, it ties in again with this idea that we're talking about neutrality being more of a propagandistic kind of window dressing. I mean, Turkmenistan's always had a very pragmatic interpretation of what its neutrality means. If you look at the rhetorical content, it's actually quite an empty concept. So, I mean, in the early years when Turkmenistan was decoupling itself from Russian security frameworks, it was the first Central Asian state to join NATO's Partnership for Peace program. So even though they were using neutrality as an excuse to decouple from Russia, it was still actively seeking partnership with NATO in this sense. So, I mean, this is kind of contradictory. So this application of neutrality is actually politically motivated, depending on the regime's strategy at the time. In regards to the Northern Distribution Network, yeah, of course, Turkmenistan offered its airspace for the actors involved in Afghanistan, which, you know, seems to defy the very basic principle of what neutrality is. So really it's about the regime's threat perceptions again and how it pragmatically tries to play actors off against one another and kind of sustain its own interests.
But it also seems to me that there's something like a threshold of neutrality that we can say has either been crossed or hasn't been crossed. But that threshold to me seems to be very debatable. And one of the things that I find interesting as well is that there seems to be a debate over what that threshold constitutes now, right? So, and this threshold seems to be being defined differently by Moscow and Washington, D.C., for example, right? And it seems to change with the times as their interests vary as well in the region, right? So I think recently, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think recently Putin made a statement to the effect of, you know, if Turkmenistan's having trouble with their borders, we're going to step in and help them or, you know, something to this effect. I think he was referring in particular to the Afghani-Turkmenistani border. So, you know, what's the threshold of neutrality for an actor like Moscow versus the threshold of neutrality for an actor like Washington, D.C., in your opinion?
Well, I mean, just to take the discussion back, I mean, when we talked about the case of Finland, as well as with Sweden, part of the basic obligation of neutrality is to provide a sense of stability to your neighbors, not just yourself. So this usually constitutes a basic understanding of territorial defense. The problem with Turkmenistan at the moment, particularly with the border concerns, is it's not meeting a basic obligation of neutrality to protect its own neighbours. The Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, who are wishing to expand into Central Asia, of course Turkmenistan is the weak link in this security chain. So, of course, actors like Moscow are actually quite worried now. And, you know, there's been a lot of critique across the region. Even Kazakhstan, which is a major ally of Turkmenistan, has been criticizing what's happening at the border. But Turkmenistan is very indignant and denies that there's anything wrong at the border, and it you know, it's still upholding this position of neutrality. It's still not willing to bring in outside actors for the time being, though there has been negotiations and discussions going on behind the scenes.
So as the situation at the border deteriorates, it seems to be drawing into question then Turkmenistani neutrality, not necessarily because there's a shift in the position coming from Turkmenistan itself, but because there's a position from actors that are involved in the region around Turkmenistan. And to me, that's fascinating. You know, and it really raises the question, is neutrality a viable option for Turkmenistan today?
I mean, really, neutrality has always been quite disastrous. It's been slightly beneficial for the regime. You know, it helped them. In fact, one of their main foreign policy achievements was really their dealings with the Taliban in the early days. You know, when they provided oil and some electricity in exchange for kind of peace and stability at the border. The difference now is they do not have a good relationship with the Taliban, and this has really led to a deteriorating situation on the border. Really, neutrality is particularly in the Turkmen conceptualization of it, of being kind of an isolationist strategy. This has been disastrous. It's led to the economy becoming entirely dependent on gas. It's now dependent entirely on China. We're seeing the currency devaluation that took place. The economy is in a lot of problem at the moment because it has a export crisis, essentially. And this is why they're pushing for these pipeline projects, such as TAPI to India. They've even talked about the Trans-Caspian. I mean, they're really... Isolation has backed them into a corner. They've became isolated, and now isolation is seen as a threat to the regime's stability.
Of course, you know, there is, or at least there should be, a distinction between isolationism and neutrality, right? Like, Ireland likes to think of itself as a neutral actor, certainly doesn't think of itself as an isolated actor. I think a lot of people here make the argument that multinational corporations, for example, are one of the major reasons why you have, or it's a major base for MNCs anyways. So, you know, what strikes me is that in this particular space, in Turkmenistan, it seems like neutrality and isolationism are actually kind of going hand in hand in a way that might not reflect other neutral actors elsewhere.
Right, I mean, this is very true. I mean, like we talked about with Scandinavia, you know, they're normative actors. They actually legitimize themselves by promoting norms of neutrality, by advancing humanitarian aid and so forth. So it's actually important to their domestic conceptualization of what neutrality is to actually be active in the international community. What's interesting with Turkmenistan is to understand that its neutrality is called the doctrine of positive neutrality. You know, there's that emphasis on the positive, you know, cooperation kind of characteristic in it, but they've made no efforts whatsoever to emphasize this positive dimension. Really, they've just emphasized the neutral dimension, which has been taken to mean isolationist kind of insulation, really, that they pursued. So it's very different to the other neutral actors, particularly the European variety.
Well, and part of me wonders, like, for example, you know, some other neutral actors, they're still, not only are they shaping norms, but they're actively being shaped by them, right? Not just norms, but also economic processes, right? So you have a situation where Ireland is neutral, and that neutrality has been built into things like the Lisbon Treaty, for example, and yet it's still a member of the European Union, right? So it's definitely not isolated. And I think this is an interesting case with Turkmenistan, then, whereby isolationism is really pursued as a strategy to protect the regime from norms. And I almost wonder how much of this came in response to Turkmenistani elites sort of looking to other regional neighbors or partners or what have you, and they saw, for example, their power perhaps being undermined by, you know, sort of liberal norms. You know, so when you look to things like the colored revolutions in the early 2000s, for example, you know, and I don't know, have you read or thought about this at all? Like, is there a connection here between, you know, pursuing not just neutrality, but to a great extent, isolationism from the world community as a way to avoid the world community having any sort of leverage over the Turkmenistani regime in terms of promoting more human rights domestically, for example?
Well, for me, a lot of it ties into, you know, theories of kind of regionalism. The point is, with the European Union, as we've built a region around the area, including the neutral states, which are connected economically, there's a giving up of a sense of certain levels of sovereignty to a supranational level. There's a kind of the power sharing agreements that take place in developing a region. The difference of Central Asia is it's very detached. There's no sense of connectedness or power sharing. All the states are authoritarian regimes to varying degrees. Kyrgyzstan has a parliamentary system, so I mean it's not fair to criticize it that way, but I mean all in all there's very little efforts put in to build a sense of regionalism, and they have a very strict sense of sovereignty. This is particularly in the SCO. The whole framework is actually still very much about preserving strict separation of the state's sovereignty. So I mean in this sense it's very difficult for Central Asia to actually unify on any common issues. I mean things like the water depletion around the region is at crisis levels, yet the states can barely cooperate on matters as simple as that, or food security. So, I mean, Turkmenistan's is a very extreme form of preservation of its sovereignty, but it's no different, really, to the other actors in the region.
Do you see any other actors in the region kind of using this, you know, this threat or of the border dispute, also, you know, the militants and radical extremists to try and get them more engaged in sort of a policy that might not be neutral, a policy that might favor, for example, joining NATO or joining the Collective Security Organization?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of that across Central Asia, actually. I mean, the Russian media in particular, like RT and Sputnik and so forth, they've really emphasized the ISIS threat in the region, particularly Afghanistan. Now, of course, there is ISIS actors there, and there is Central Asians fleeing to join ISIS. But the numbers are very small compared to other regions, including Europe. So this can be seen as part of the propaganda of Russia and bolstering this sense of a need for a security framework where Russia can actually lead. In terms of Turkmenistan, yeah, of course, some actors are really actively pushing for a cessation of this neutrality, in particular Russia, again, which has been criticized in the policy of neutrality quite openly. Lately, it's really seeking to cooperate, particularly on the border. There's rumors as well that Turkmenistan was working with Uzbeks. I mean, none of this has been verified yet. But there's also the American dimension, of course, and there is kind of negotiations which are taking place and security technology and so forth.
Okay, so do you know if anything special happens on Neutrality Day? I mean, are there any sort of symbolic, other than just declaring it Neutrality Day, do you know if there's anything that happens locally that, like a parade of neutrality or something like this?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's a large parade. There will be a presidential speech. Of course, it will all be based on Arkadag, the Great Protector, as he dubs himself. So, I mean, again, it's important to understand the propagandistic aspect of positive neutrality that's very much tied up and embodied in the person of the president, whether it was Niyazov or Berdimuhamedov. The point is, he will be glorified through support for neutrality. He will very much promote, look at the stability that this policy has given us, look at the wealth we have, look at how great Ashgabat is with all its marble facade, this sort of thing. So, I mean, neutrality is tied up in this propaganda, and it will be, you know, flaunted quite blatantly on Neutrality Day.
All right. Well, in that case, seeing as it is Friday evening here in Dublin, I think I'll go have a drink in the name of Turkish Turkmenistani neutrality. Thanks very much for joining us today, Bradley, and happy neutrality.
Thank you for having me.
Turkmenistan'ın karşılığının şanlı 23 yıllık bayramçılığı münasebetli kutlayarım.